What we now want to do is let you all in on the debate. And I don't know if should I be moderating? You want to be moderating? What do you want to do? We'll co-moderate. You can feel free to ask a question of the participants, or you can just, you know, talk from your own experience. Please.
Historical examples of that, of the sort of thing you're looking for. I don't know of too many
exclude current ones, although I think that Ashanti is right that they're there. A lot of them are happening, you know, under the radar. The one I know is in Latin America, especially South America, in the 60s and 70s, you know, there's upsurge in national liberation politics, but tradition from, you know, back in the 20th century. And people like, there's a guy named Abraham Guillen, who was armed struggle in the cities, but he is still alive at like 98 or something. But his experience came out of Spain and working with the anarchists in the Spanish Revolution, Civil War, and he brought in a way that I don't think works all the time, but that tradition is still very strong in some extent, especially in the southern cone, Argentina, Uruguay, Sweden, Brazil. Sometimes when I hear people put nationalism into the same bag as racism, it's like I hear a limitation on nationalism. You know, although I understand that there is certain connection in there. All right. For me, that nationalism still means that you kind of maintain some sort of dignity or self-esteem that has allowed us to move through the daily assaults on movies. In your situation, I think that that's why, like today, when we, like I agree with others who say this is a postmodern world. You know, it's like categories have to be shaken up. You know, there are no more easy categories anymore. But what that means is that, you know, we have to figure out some of this, and how we do this world pre-triggered to politics. You know, it's like, how do we create that type of space now so that everybody doesn't have to fit into a neat category? Because there are definitely black people who, in the nationalist community, would not be accepted. You know, a black person was into punk, but those of us who are activists are trying to break that down, you know, from those punk activists to others who see that, the
same thing around. Narrow nationalists who can only see women fitting in a certain way. So therefore, we have to break that down too. But I think that's a part of the world we live in today and why it is taken for granted. You know, and like, you know, like that identity one is one of my things.
I just want to comment. I think it's interesting historically, the link exactly, I completely agree it's not the same, that maybe historically over the past 100 years or so, because nationalism has, in order to understand people as science, and the elite understood that was by coming up with racialized categories to do that. Now that's breaking down. There's like religious categories or sexuality categories or gender categories. But and I think that's totally, that's more than anything, I think that's a really important sense of not just being thrown together because you are being thrown together by society, but I think we all need communities. And you didn't find it in one or two or three of these other identities that you had or communities that you were sort of born into, but you made a self-chosen community. And that's why, for me, nationalism and anarchism, in a way, have become prefigurative politics, is what are the communities we choose right now? But in, as a prefigurative politics, I hope we can move beyond survival and see community as being something that allows us to thrive, and then maybe the boundaries start blurring, and we're members of multiple communities, because to thrive means more than this narrow identity. But I think, unfortunately, science and sort of the elite have tended to link nationalism and racism together, which is obviously not exactly what it is.
Because I'm from New York, this is why I really don't want to leave New York, because I think New York has great potential. It is so rich in different people, different cultures. And like today, like the community that I live in, I'm in Flatbush, I'm in Brooklyn, and it's like, just moved there from Bed-Stuy, which is pretty predominantly African-American. Flatbush is predominantly African-American, Haitian, Latino, and African, you know? And that's different, you know? So I couldn't use the same definition of black community that I did in the 60s. That has to change, you know? And then, I mean, there's other communities within the black communities, and it's like to make sure that in this phase of the struggle that definition becomes more inclusive. And I think that's our job to do. We have to keep enriching that definition. And so it's not going to necessarily be the definition it was, you know, in the 60s.
Did Heather?
Um, also just on your nationalism leads to racism.
Potentially.
Okay, potentially, and here's my challenge, because this is a debate, all right? Anarchism was coming here from different European countries in the early 1900s, you know, was coming up. But then what happened when, maybe after a generation or two, that they're now not anarchists anymore, and their children are now part of being an American, you know? And maybe at some point those some of those children become anarchists. But this is a racist country. So the problem, one of the problems that we're dealing with now is that the anarchist movement in the United States produces racism because it hasn't challenged its own racism. You know, and I don't say this because when I hear even the potential, it happens within the anarchist movement, because that's my biggest stumbling block, is that we're having a hard time getting through this, where the potential to get through it means that we can build one of the most powerful movements this country has seen, maybe one that can't be destroyed this time. But we got to deal with it. I mean, it happened. The thing about the indigenous movement, I think the key thing is that today we're more cognizant that everyone has a right to determine their own destiny. You know, the Native Americans, the indigenous people from wherever they're at. And there's something in there that we want to respect, that is because we have a way of thinking that we think got it all together, we don't want to, like, make decisions for others on how they should live or get to judge it to such a point that we dismiss it if it doesn't meet our intellectual standards. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, for me, a lot of the postmodern things make sense to me, because it's telling me that, okay, a lot of these concepts come out of Europe and stuff like that, and there's a whole intellectual standard that you have to meet in order for something to be valid. And if it doesn't meet that, then it isn't valid. When I was in the Panther Party, you learn Lenin's and all the definition of nation, so you judge whether a group of people were a nation based off of that standard. If they didn't meet it, one point out, they're not a nation. You know, so for me it's like, okay, people are struggling. You know, the Zapatistas are struggling. If they don't meet somebody's standards, they are struggling for self-determination, doing a pretty good job under some very difficult circumstances. And I think that's the thing that we have in common. Like, black people here are struggling under certain circumstances. Puerto Rican people are struggling. Native Americans are struggling. And it may not meet everybody's definition, but we got to find ways of supporting it nonetheless. And it may well be that there's certain things in their traditions that are very anarchistic. I came in because of anarchism. And so that was my interest. I was like, I got to go for this, because I am in a desperate search for some people of color anarchists all around the world. But I'm halfway through it, and I get it. And what he's saying is that Wolesa Yenka, the only way to understand him is through the lens of anarchism. And I went on the internet and I started trying to find some stuff by Wolesa Yenka, and I found some speeches, and he kind of speaks favorably about anarchism, you know. So I said, oh, I want to get this dissertation. The thing cost me $30. I didn't like that, but anyhow, he says that Wolesa Yenka focuses on the Yoruba, which is the people he's from, all right, and that there's this thing in their culture that some of, you know, like I say, I got the Yoruba and other indigenous people use them with the world or their world, their cosmos, to connect them with their god figures, and there's certain god figures that they have that are like symbols of anarchism. And so what he's saying is that Wolesa Yenka and his work always highlights those gods and their relationship with the people that gives them a chance to change whatever it is in their society, to say that there's nothing permanent in that society. So I found that to be very interesting. But his definition, the person who did the dissertation, he used a definition of anarchism that is not Western definition. But when you read it, it has the same anarchistic sensibility, the same themes and stuff like that. So it makes me sit back and say, okay, there's going to be some anarchisms that come about that are not necessarily traditional. But it makes sense if you can, you know, like get into it. So I mean, that became very certain things that they do, which I think is why a lot of us have a desire to want to find out about how did the Native Americans live here before the Europeans came, or how do different indigenous people live today that is so anarchistic, you know, because there's lessons in there for us to learn. So it's like we want to learn the lessons, but we don't necessarily want to go in there and make sure they read Kropotkin, Buckingham. If they're doing all right the way that they are, they're just saying, I want technology out of my life. I want the West out of my life. I think that's great. You know, because they're saying, leave me fuck alone. You know, let us live the way that we've been doing it. You know, and that's why the Zapatistas are very interesting to me in terms of what they're doing.
More questions? Yeah, first one.
What is a good position in the Middle East, because I'm culturally Jewish, although not religious. And the only time I recognized myself as Jewish was when I lived in Germany for 2 years and realized I've always been around Jews, and suddenly, whoa, they've all been killed. And it's really palpable. Every day something reminded you, and I don't know what it feels like to be a person called in the United States, but I understood what suddenly it meant to be a Jew. And I was a Jew in Germany suddenly when I wasn't here. So what the hell is an anarchist who's kind of Jewish and doesn't like states, but yet self-determination? In a way, I think that's why I started thinking of this, is how do we look at prefigurative politics? And I think you have to support people's desire to self-determine. Oh, okay. Okay.
Technology.
But I think I think what's interesting about the Middle East is that people don't think of it in like a longer term historical and global context. Self-determine, and I think, but what that could look like when there's a Palestinian state, which I think there should be much as I don't support states, is it's going to be ugly. And then I'll have to oppose the Palestinian state. But now I have to support it in a sense because people need the ability to at least try. But I think that the people that are going to form that state right now, the second intifada is very different, and it's going to be an ugly state. And maybe it would have been a nicer state if they formed it for the first intifada, which is much more directly democratic. Now it's not. At the same time that I can't support the state of Israel, I have to support it in the context globally of why focus on that one state. And I heard a Palestinian man speak, who's from Chicago recently, and he said, you know, if you think about anti-Semitism globally, it makes you see that you have to support both a Palestinian state and an Israeli state until there's no anti-Semitism. And then an Israeli state makes no sense, and he's more for secular democratic society. And so that's why I had it in the Middle East and capitalism, and I remember the survival in a people, but they don't need a goddamn state of Israel, but they do, because there's anti-Semitism. And I think it becomes, that's why I think as an anarchist I start thinking, well, what would a prefigurative position be on the Middle East? And maybe if you support self-determination, you decry consistently terrorism and anti-Semitism and racism, and all these things happen simultaneously, and you talk about, you know, directly democratic non-state solutions. And that the Middle East is such a, I think, a good example of, like, all the real genocide going on and killing the oil. I'm like, you know, that is just, it's such a historical replication of something. There's a Jewish conspiracy. They control the world. That's why, that's not why it's happening. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons you could say the state of Israel is bad, but it's not because Jews control world oil behind the scenes somehow. In fact, there isn't oil. I mean, but we shouldn't replicate. That's why we shouldn't replicate our bad positions in relation to that. But anyway, that's why I think for me as an anarchist, I think we have to work really hard to maintain ambiguities and tensions and understand, you know, support the struggle. And the minute the Palestinians get a state, you know, take off the Palestinian scarf and start rejecting that state just like we reject other states, because it'll probably be ugly. No.
I thought a lot in my personal views was much protection in mind and all that.
We're going to play soccer to settle that one. Is it cool with the panel if we take a couple of questions to give more people a chance? Go ahead.
I asked you this topic. I'm wondering if anybody has ever considered more of a subjective level what you're talking about, as far as like people with nationalism or any other closed system. I mean, it seems like that's one of my problems with nationalism. And I'm also, as my friends are, the lobbyists who are mixing with the racism.
Lumping proletariat being banned. I still hold a lot of that now.
But it's just not the vanguard. I still just think that because of lumping like street organizations and people, you know, from that underclass position, have been through so much on a daily basis that they're more ready to deal with revolutionary ideas and concepts and analysis and fighting back. They're already fighting back. Sometimes it just sometimes doesn't take a revolutionary form. It's just very reactionary, but it's survival. At where I work now, we deal with providing services for ex-prisoners. And there's also an alternative to incarceration aspect, and a lot of people who come in through the alternatives to incarceration haven't really done any time, but a lot of them are Crips and Bloods, and so that, I'm in the GED program to interact with them. And one of the things I'll show them is like video that I hope they can begin to see their role different. So one of them, of course, is Black Panther Party. Real key about it. By the way, they can identify with the Panthers and everything until you talk about right now. And their thing about right now is that should have never worked. You know, they can see it, they understand it, the whole bit. You don't have to go into no long nothing. But they don't see the possibility of victory. So it's like, yo, there's no victory, I got to do for me. You know, and that's where the struggle lies with helping them to see the possibility of victory. You know, at on some small levels. I mean, because, you know, it's not going to be no big victory no time soon. But at least they got to be able to see that this is a duel. And that's like the real challenge of activists. I mean, you have, and even you talk about people that's caught up in the public assistance, there's things that they do to help each other out, to keep the family fed, to look out for neighbors' children or whatever, that they already do, that we would consider anarchistic as looking out. It's just community. It's just basic looking out. But they need to see that coming together, we can change our world. And that's really the big block right there, that we haven't been able to do that, you know, with them. And therefore, they're just going day by day. They're just making it. So it's like the oppression seems to be so massive, so vast, that there is no way that we can really win. And I think that's our challenge. We have to show that there's ways to win.
I just say that sort of response you outlined tend to speak at is pretty much identical to the position that I've long been in the position of the Puerto Ricans that I work with. That, you know, they're critical of structure of the organization for different reasons, and they're critical of the sort of lumping aspects of it. But they also understand that it is, you know, a critical response to capitalism in urban America. So they don't just condemn it that way. But I've begun to think of it in terms of just sort of like the way Chicago politics operates in such a machine basis. Everything in Chicago operates like this. Community organizations are all about like turf and setting up their own little machines that either work with or against the political machines in their wards. And similarly, like the underground economy is structured that way too. It's all about turf and setting up your own little machine that, you know, sometimes it's gonna work with the cops in the district and sometimes it's gonna work against them, and sometimes it's gonna work with the community organizations on the side or with the aldermen on the side or whatever. So I've become more and more cynical about the corruption of that sort of stuff as years go on, and I, as a result, have pretty much zero use for any street organization that I'm familiar with.
I just want to say quick, because I just think that with this prison industrial complex, that the people who are going first into the mouth of this monster is the lumpen. And they save them, then they will still prey on our very community. They become that force of crime that actually crime becomes control. That system uses, you know, because they're going to continue to make sure that the drugs are there, the guns are there, you know, and with the whole culture of the fast dollar, that's going to be like a real big block in our ability to become self-determined. And it's, so for me, it's like, that's where I want to work, because it's like, if we don't get them, if we can't help them to turn around, I really don't see the possibility of winning. At least as far as the black community.